Good morning, everyone. In the spirit of starting in a timely fashion, we will begin this House Committee on Transportation Policy Wednesday, March 15th, 2017, and a fine Wednesday it is. We have our colleague, Representative Lively, here, so in deference to his very, very busy schedule, I would like to open a public hearing on... I'm going to get my number right.
2464.
House Bill 2464, and invite Representative Lively to come up. And Tim, would you give us the rundown on this bill, please?
Tim McEwen, members of the committee. House Bill 2464 eliminates caps on number of vehicles eligible to participate in a road usage charge program, requires the Department of Transportation to establish a method for a purchaser of lightweight vehicle to register for the program at point of purchase, and requires vehicles of model year 2026 or later and an EPA rating at or above 20 miles per gallon or equivalent to be registered in the road usage charge program, and takes effect on 91st day sine die. We have there has been no revenue or fiscal issued on this yet.
Thank you. And I would note that the road user task force, we will be having an informational hearing on that, and just subsequent to Representative Lively testifying on what this bill is. This bill is the culmination of a lot of work that's gone on for some time.
Right.
So, Representative Lively, if you'd like to say a few words, then sure. ODOT's going to come up and talk all about the program.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm John Lively, House District 12 State Representative from Springfield, and I appreciate your providing me this chance to testify before I go on and listen to people's concerns about education budgets. So I'm here to encourage you to support House Bill 2464. I've been a member of the Road User Task Force for, I think, about 2 years now, and have learned a lot about that. Before that, when I served on the Transportation Committee, we discussed over the time several times about this whole road user fee and how it was going or wasn't going and what the intent had been since it was started. So since serving on the task force itself, I've learned a lot and become more convinced it makes sense in the long term is where we go. I also currently serve on the Joint Committee on Transportation Preservation and Modernization, which Chair McEwen also serves on, where we're trying to craft a transportation package to address transportation needs that we have in the state. And one of the things we know, and all of you certainly are aware of, our transportation system is essentially wore out. It has to do with years, the age of the system. It has to do with the amount of traffic that's on the system today versus what it were, the weight of the trucks, all kind of people's changing habits of how they do it. So overall, the system is wore out. The second thing we know in doing that, working on that, is that our revenues, what we use to pay to fix the system, hasn't kept up over the years for a lot of different reasons. One, we haven't raised the gas tax in recent years, and that's our primary source for transportation for bridges and roads. We haven't raised the gas tax, but additionally, the gas tax we have has continued to diminish as a source as vehicles become more efficient and people's driving patterns have changed. And so we know from that standpoint. So my concern now, as we craft this new package and rely primarily on gas tax again for building and maintaining our roads, is we're going to be faced with the same situation in a few years out, as even if we are successful in raising the gas tax, it's going to continue to diminish as a source as vehicles become more efficient, certainly as more electrical vehicles are joining the fleet. It'll become a diminishing source and we'll be facing an ongoing problem, even a bigger problem than we have today. That's why I'm here to support this particular measure. So what, from my standpoint, what the measure does, it just continues what we're already doing, because we already have this user fee that some people are participating in. It's on a voluntary basis. This measure would allow us to take the cap off. There's now a cap of 5,000 members that can participate and where there would be no cap, which would open up to more people being able to convert to the system. But more importantly, from my standpoint, is it starts us down the path to convert the fleet, starting in with model year 2026, all light vehicles that have an EPA rating of 20 miles per gallon or higher would automatically be enrolled in the system. So as more and more vehicles become more efficient, we would set up a system where they would automatically be rolled and they would be in the system. Certainly the long-term goal, from my standpoint, should be that everybody at some point is using, being charged through the road user fee. For me, technically, it seems very simple that people ought to pay for what they use. And the system we have now, because of the efficiency of automobiles and things, has really changed what I call the fair share that people pay for the use of the roads. And this system, frankly, will start moving us towards that and hopefully get there. Who knows where technology is going to go and what future transportations, but we have a long ways out before all of that changes. But this system gets there. So I feel strongly that it's important as part of us moving forward with a new transportation packing addressing our needs that we also address this portion of it and put in place a plan to be moving off so dependent on the gas tax and moving to the road user fee. And I certainly hope that we can find a way to support House Bill 2464. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Sure. Any questions for? Yes, sir. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So would the 20 MPG be designated by the in-city and highway usage on the
EPA sticker.
Yeah,
that's right.
On the side of the car. So then they would be, if it's a gas or diesel. Oh, I'm sorry. Follow up.
Yes.
So if it's a gas or diesel powered car, then they would be paying the gas tax, the existing gas tax plus a mileage tax.
No, they would pay one or the other. They don't pay both.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, just yes, Vice Chair Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I'm not familiar with the program. So how does that work at the gas pump when you go to the gas pump?
So currently what happens, those people that are participating, they pay the gas tax, and then as they submit reports on their road usage fee, it's adjusted for what they're being charged, 1.5 cents per mile. So it's adjusted back to the gas tax. The state gas tax is 30 cents. So depending on how many miles they've driven, it's adjusted back. And most people that are currently participating, the goal was it would be comparable, the 1.5 cents. I mean, most people that are in the program find that to be true, that they have a little credit, or they owe a little money depending on the miles and their gas mileage is the way the current system works.
Okay, so it's a reporting system.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair.
And Representative Lively, I'm asking my staff to print out my most current Orgo statement,
thank
and
you.
They're having trouble printing it, so hopefully I will have it here for you all to look at shortly. I've been a participant now for about a year. I drive an average car with an average mileage rating. I drive a lot.
A lot.
And my Orgo statement every month shows how many miles I drove, what the equivalent gas tax would be for the number of gallons that I've purchased. It credits me for the gas tax that I've paid, charges me for what the 1.5 cent a mile would be, and then I either pay the difference or there's a credit. And this last month I spent, I think, $3.56 extra because of, I think, a lot of miles that I drive. But I'll try and have that for you shortly. And I know when our informational hearing occurs, you're going to learn a lot more about what's going on.
Great.
Yes, Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, and maybe you can answer this. So the administrative cost for sending that in, figuring it out, is it all computerized or is there a...
Mine is all electronic. It's digital. I get a digital statement. But, I'm not the expert on this. We have the people in the room that are. Thank you, Representative Lively.
Thank you very much.
So I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2464, and I will open an informational hearing from the Oregon Department of Transportation on the Road User Fee Task Force / Orgo. Welcome. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. My name is Maureen Bach. I'm the Orgo Program Manager from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Sorry, it's a little early this morning.
It is early.
So thank you for having me here today. Representative Lively did a nice job of teeing up the conversation for you. As he mentioned, fuel tax becomes a decreasing source of dependable revenue for us in about 2020, according to our estimates. So that's in part because of fuel efficiency of the fleet overall becoming much, much more efficient. So despite the growth in motor vehicle fuel, VMT is increasing in the state, but it's not keeping pace, even with the fuel
tax. And VMT, just for the committee,
vehicle miles traveled.
Thank you.
So So this is kind of the backdrop for why the Road User Fee Task Force has been looking at this for so long.
Thank you.
So the Road User Fee Task Force was actually created by House Bill 3946 in 2001, and they were established to look at developing a long-term vision for how we fund transportation in the future. And so they have actually been working on this for quite some time, and they developed some principles that they wanted to use to look at various revenue sources. These were key principles. User pays in particular was one that was key, and getting the public to accept whatever funding mechanism was needed. And they wanted it to be transparent. So we've spent a lot of time working on these things. Those principles all underlie three pilots that were done. The first pilot was done in 2006 and 2007, and it actually used technology was developed to put in vehicles, and it had two service stations that actually netted out the fuel tax. The rest of the people actually kept their receipts and sent them in. They also zoned the Portland area, so it could show that it was viable to be the basis for congestion charges. The second pilot was done in 2012 and 2013, and it showed that it was feasible to do vehicle-to-machine communication of mileage information. And at that point, they had private sector account managers collecting that information, in part because the public was concerned about government having information about their trips. So each one of these pilots has like been built on those principles and has been incorporated into the one that we have now, which is the ORGO program. ORGO program is a production system. We have three private sector account managers, and we are responsible for the oversight of those account managers and the compliance of the direct payers and for making sure that the vehicles are eligible. Senate Bill 810 was actually the bill that created this program. It was passed in 2013. Those are the key components of it. People pay 1.5 cents per mile. They receive a fuel tax credit. So as you know, you pay for your fuel at the pump, and then as you use the fuel tax that is on the gallons used to travel your taxable miles, you get that credited back to you. People are given choices of which account manager they want to sign up with. We have, like I said, three. Vehicle location technology was not to be required. So we have GPS-enabled devices and basic non-GPS devices in the program. We had to be open to new technology. So as changes occur, we needed to be able to be flexible in bringing those into the program. And, of course, there are penalties for fraud, and there was the need for protection of personal information. So your trip information is aggregated when it comes to ODOT. The account managers get that information at detail level, so they can bill you for your miles without that being a problem. So those are all built into our production system. What is the road usage charge? It's just basically a fee you pay for each mile you drive. We collect the fuel tax. It's treated as a prepayment of your road usage charge. As the miles are counted, we net out the fuel tax, and people either pay the tax or they get a refund under the current program. The volunteer experience for people that sign up, like the chair here, went to the website, picked an account manager, signed up, determined the vehicle is eligible, got a nifty little box like this, got this little device, put it in the onboard diagnostic port of her vehicle. That activated her account, and then she drives. And that's the experience. And then, like I said, you either pay or you get a refund. When we first started the program, we thought that the less efficient vehicles would be the ones that would enroll because they would have an economic incentive. They would be getting a refund. What we found initially is Priuses were the first vehicles to sign up, and for a long time they were the most abundant vehicle that was signed up. The Ford F-150 and the Super Outbacks are catching up with them, but overall we've had about 300 models in the program. So we have a really good broad base of knowledge with these. We monitor what our participation rate is. We monitor what our volunteers have to say. And in fall of last year, we actually had Public Knowledge, which is a external QA firm, look at, well, they actually did a survey of our volunteers, and one of the things they found is that 71% of the volunteers in the program actually support the road usage charge for highly efficient vehicles. And that support actually has increased over the general public by virtue of being in the program. That was one of the things they noted. As of today, we have over 1,000 vehicles that have been in the program. Some of them are no longer with us because they've changed, they've moved out of state or whatever, for whatever reason, are no longer with us. But like I said, we have more than 300 different models that have been in the program, including electric vehicles. One of the concerns that people have is the impact on urban and rural drivers, particularly in the eastern part of the state. So Oregon State University actually did an economic analysis last year, and what they found is that overall, under a road usage charge system, Oregonians would be on average about a nickel more a day to drive. But the impact on that is that in the eastern part of the state, rural drivers would actually pay less than that nickel a day. So that's what this map shows, is the impact of whether you pay the nickel or less than the nickel or more. And of course, in your Medford, you're breaking even on that nickel. We are currently undertaking an evaluation of the program. We've had three external contracts done. Info at Risk is a cybersecurity firm in Eugene. They looked at the security of our system, and they determined that we are using the best practices available right now to protect security, and we're focused on operational requirements, and so we're keeping pace with what the thinking is in that area. Public Knowledge did the account manager satisfaction survey and the volunteer satisfaction survey. They are, like I said, an external quality assurance firm, national firm. They have found that we have very good communication with our third-party account managers. We have very clear expectations. We keep those foremost in the program by having weekly meetings with our account managers to make sure we're diagnosing problems and dealing with them timely. And for volunteers, most of the volunteers support road usage charging. Their experience has generally been positive, and like I said, they have concerns about the impact on rural drivers, which we are trying to address through talking about the research that's been done by OSU. There are also concerns about out-of-state drivers. We're the first state, just like when we did fuel tax, we were the first state to do that too. We're the first state to actually have a functioning road usage charge system where we're collecting revenue. So what are we doing to improve the program? We currently are undertaking some additional work under the FAST Act, which was Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act. That was passed in 2015 at the federal level, made grants available to study road usage charging across the country. So we at ODOT applied for a grant, received it. We wanted to look at expanding the market, increasing public awareness of transportation funding in total, as well as what the road usage charge does and how it fits into that. Wanted to look at compliance for both account payers and account managers, and then explore interoperability with other states and with other jurisdictions within the state. So expanding the market means looking at more technology choices. California is just concluding a pilot, and they tested the embedded telematics and cell phone imagery, where you take a snapshot of your dash that shows your odometer and sends that in, and there's apparently metadata attached to that image that allows them to determine it's your vehicle. They also want to look at data aggregation. So we think we can leverage what California learned in our program and determine whether or not it works here with sufficient accuracy, or maybe more importantly, what if it doesn't work, whether or not we have it in the program. So we want to move away from this little device to something else, essentially. We also want to increase public awareness. Like I said, we've done some research. We have some idea about how the public feels about road usage charging. generally, there's a lack of understanding generally about how transportation is funded, so we want to leverage that and show the road usage charging in context of the greater transportation funding. And then we want to create some educational tools and try them out and see how people respond. We also want to evaluate compliance. We have, you know, the three-legged stool of compliance, education, assistance, and enforcement. We do a pretty good job in education assistance, but we don't really have any enforcement mechanisms right now. So we're looking at what currently is in place in other program areas and seeing if there's some things that might be beneficial to have in a road usage charge program should it become mandatory. We also want to work on interoperability, and the idea there is that you would have one account associated with your vehicle from which you could pay other transportation services, and that the funds then are collected accurately for the services that you receive and that they are transmitted to the jurisdiction appropriately. And just to give you an example, Portland has a vision that at some point you would be able to have an account from which you could pay for parking and maybe transit and some other services. So that's kind of an idea there. Or partnering with any other jurisdiction like DEQ or something like that. Now, Senate Bill 810 also had Section 29, which is a key component of some additional work that ODOT is doing. It allowed us to partner with other states to study road usage charging, and that is what we are doing with the Western Road Usage Charge Consortium, which is also known as REC West. As you can see, those are the member states. We are the blue one there with the only active program. California is concluding their pilot, as is Colorado. They weren't actually capturing real money. They were using just capturing the data to determine what the impact would be. Washington is actively getting ready to do a pilot. And then the other states are participating in research and those kinds of activities. REC West also received a FAST Act grant, so they are looking at designing a system that takes into consideration all of the requirements for others that the states that are participating there. I think there are 11 of the 14 states that are participating in that body of work. Looking at how the business rules would be, what requirements are mandatory, which are maybe desirable to have. They're going to design the system with this money and then look at the technology interfaces. A key component is doing a common concept of operations under this work. And then after that, they would be seeking federal support to look at an interoperable REC system between two states, probably California and Oregon at this point. So that's the high-level overview of what I do. It's kind of fun stuff, actually. It's that cutting edge of policy and operations. So are there any questions?
I just wanted to note that I attended a national transportation chairs conference a few months ago, and I became known as, oh, she's the one from Oregon where they're piloting this program, and everybody across the country is watching us very closely to see how this unfolds, because it's an issue that every single state is dealing with. And it was interesting to hear the questions that they had, of course, the concerns that they have, but also their acknowledgement that we have to do something different in the future. So we've become the poster child for this program, and it was really fun to be a part of those conversations with as far along as we are. But there are challenges and there are concerns, so I'll turn to the committee to see what questions they might have. Yes, Vice
Thank
Chair
you,
Meek.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a quick question. Does the technology delineate whether it's a public road or a private road? Or say you're out in the country driving on a gravel road that's not maintained. How does that work?
Chair McEwen, Representative Meek, members of the committee, that's a great question. That is a challenge, I will say. With the GPS device, it's more likely that we can differentiate those, but there aren't really any good definitions of what's really a private or public road. And with GPS, it's hard to determine as well. So if you're driving on a gravel road that parallels a highway, with GPS drift, it probably would show that you were on a public road. How we account for that, though, is we let people file reports that show that they're private roads. And if you have a non-GPS device and you drive out of state, you can also file a paper report and get a refund. So that's how we handle that currently.
That's great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know that there's been a great concern since this program began, and I know it began, what, in 2005 and 6 when the legislation passed. I didn't join the program until about a year ago, so my information is rather new. But one of the concerns that came up in the 2013 session and again in the 2015 session is the idea of people's grave concern about having a device installed in their car. And you mentioned that there are three ways that you can join this program. Could you give just a little bit more detail about an individual who may want to participate, is uncomfortable with an electronic device, and what their interaction was with the DMV, how they actually make that happen as a participant?
Chair McEwen, thank you for letting me clarify that. Currently, the only option for someone to participate is to have this device in their car, and that's one reason we are looking at other options. Because road usage charging, we don't have a way to look at odometer readings currently with our account managers.
So did the pilot change at some point in time? Because I was under the understanding at one point in time that you could go in and, on an annual basis, show your mileage and participate. Has that changed then? Because I'd like some clarification on that.
That has not been an option in this pilot, which the other two pilots, the first pilot, they actually had a device that was made by OSU installed in vehicles, mm-hmm. and the second one also had a device installed. So there are pilots in other states where they're letting people have the odometer readings or using cell phone imagery to
report. So we never made that available?
No. We are exploring a manual option under the FAST Act
that
would allow people to have a verified odometer reading as part of the program.
Okay,
so that is a body of work we're undertaking.
That is challenging, then,
right.
Because I do understand people's concerns for privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're working on that, then. You mentioned that in the future, without a device attached to your car, and again, it's akin to if you have a cell phone, people know where you are anyway. If you have OrStar on your car, people know where you are. You can kind of challenge that idea. But again, for people who truly don't want a cell phone in their car, don't want OrStar, just are very concerned about that issue, what do you see in the future? You mentioned it may happen without a device. What exactly would that look like in the future then?
So, Chair McEwen, that's a great question. One of the things that some modern cars have are embedded telematics that are basically just a way for your car to talk to mechanics, machinery, the infrastructure in vehicle to infrastructure technology, that kind of thing. That is an option, potentially, and that information, just like today, that information would go to an account manager. They would aggregate it and send it to the state.
Just like Fast Pass or something when you have an account set up when you're going through a corridor to toll and that type of thing.
OnStar is basically embedded telematics in your vehicle.
And OnStar's been around for
forever.
Many, many years. Yeah, I think all of our vehicles have OnStar. I just want to make sure we're really acknowledging that concern that people have.
And I'm glad you brought up privacy. I probably didn't talk to that enough. Privacy is a key component of the bill, and that's why the information goes to the third party. They have 30 days to hold that information, and then it must be destroyed.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it's 30 days after payment of the account, or if there's a conflict in the account, after resolution of that conflict with the account manager. We do not get that information. We do not get individual trip information at ODOT at all.
And can you touch just a little bit more on exactly what the bill does? This is a voluntary program. This is not mandated. It's an opportunity for people to kind of be on the cutting edge of where we may be headed in the future. But could you just get touch on exactly what the tenants of the bill do.
Chair McCune, may I clarify? Are you talking about 2464? Okay, 2464 lifts the 5,000 cap that we currently have under Senate Bill 810 and lets anyone participate. That potentially gives us more vehicles to experiment with in the program. It also creates a point-of-sale enrollment program, so we would be working with DMV and the auto dealers to get information out so people at the point of sale would have an option of enrolling.
Okay.
And then it makes it mandatory for in 2025 for model years 2026 and later if they have
new vehicles.
A combined EPA rating of 20 miles per gallon.
And right now this is available for any type of vehicle, but truly from a transportation system perspective, it's the very high mileage vehicles that are in essence not paying their fair share in maintaining our infrastructure, our highways and our streets and our roads. And we don't how we incentivize those high mileage vehicles is something I'd be interested in as well. So is that part of your education process? It sounds like Prius owners are all over this thing, but the truly electric car community, do you have in your plans an educational outreach to the folks who truly are paying nothing to maintain our roads and have wear and tear just like everybody else, but we're not capturing anything? So I'm curious to know how you're engaging, or if you are, with that community for whom we truly need to change the dynamic a bit.
Chair McCune, we are in contact with the electric vehicle community. Drive Oregon has been active participant in the program, as a matter of fact. They have been at the Road User Fee Task Force meetings, so they are participating in this. We have a number of electric vehicles that have enrolled, and that is really actually good for the program. It allows us to examine what kinds of information we can get from the onboard diagnostic port of those vehicles. As you can imagine, those ports are a little bit different in those vehicles because the port itself is actually designed to do engine diagnostics and emissions kinds of testing. And so in electric vehicles, that's not really an issue. So every time an electric vehicle enrolls, it's done on an experimental basis, and it allows the account managers then to customize their algorithms to capture the mileage information.
Great.
So we are planning to do more outreach to that community and continue to work with Drive Oregon, who has been a great partner.
Great. Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just for clarification, this is a voluntary program. If this bill passes, it's a voluntary up until 2025, and then it becomes mandatory on these vehicles.
Representative Barreto, currently the bill does not have a sunset for the voluntary program, but it seems to make sense that once it became mandatory for a certain segment of the population, the voluntary part would go away. And it's voluntary for vehicles that have a gross vehicle weight rating of 10,000 pounds or less. So the medium-duty fleet is still in that fuel tax, you know, paying fuel tax part of the program.
Yeah, and then on a different note, on your PowerPoint, I think it was the first or second slide, you had the amount of gallons that were sold back in 1990, I think, and then the number of gallons here. And I don't think the tax has gone up since 92 or something like that. But what is the current gas tax per gallon?
Representative Barreto, the current fuel tax rate is 30 cents per gallon or gallon equivalent, and it was last raised, I believe, in 2010. It was 24 cents a gallon before that.
Okay, thank
That's
you.
The state tax. There's
state
also
tax,
federal.
Right.
Yeah. And the federal tax is not raised since the 90s?
Maybe that was 92.
Mr. Campbell or Mr. Russell, do you... Federal tax was... I'm sorry? 1993 was the last time the federal gas tax was raised. Therein lies part of the issue that we're facing as a national challenge to invest in our infrastructure. So, questions? All right. Thank you very much for the information this morning. We're grateful for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So I wanted to note also that Representative Wilson is excused this morning, and I didn't notice that. I didn't note that when we gaveled in this morning, but he has been excused. He's off doing other things this morning. I had a printout done of my account. It actually has some personal information in here, so I'm not going to put it on the record. But I'd like to just read to you, if I may. Is that possible for me to do that? For the month of February, my total February mileage charges were $26.14. My fuel tax credit, which is what they credited me for what I paid in gas tax, was $22.63. So the state of Oregon benefited from my my voluntary participation in this program to the tune of $3.53, which I am more than happy to pay. And I drove 1,744.5 miles.
And what was your MPG?
That's not in here. I don't know. Fuel consumed 75.48 gallons.
We can average it out.
Yeah, you can figure that out. And I also have on here a daily, what my mileage is. It breaks it down by daily use. And it's very, very detailed. So every day I know exactly how many miles I drove, how much tax I paid, what the incremental information is that I paid to the state. And I do believe that in gross terms, the determination of whether I'm on a state highway or a public, if I go off into the boondocks, I've noted that my mileage does drop a little bit. So I think, I'm not sure how the GPS all works.
So you have GPS?
But I think I do have the device in my car, yeah. And so it does actually, I think, very accurately keep track of what the mileage is. So any other comments? We're going to start moving on. But that's what we have for the Road User Task Force in Orgo. Next, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2910. I think Representative Barreto, this is, and I've opened up a public hearing and a possible work session. It's my understanding that there is an amendment coming, but we don't have it ready, Mr. Walker. Is that correct?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
And I'd like him to give us a little update on what the bill does first, and then we'll go into the detail.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee. House Bill 2910 requires snowmobiles and certain all-terrain vehicles to cross highway at intersection or 100 feet from intersection, allows a road authority to authorize incidental use of highway right-of-way, including paved portion, shoulder, inside bank, or slope. We have heard this on March 1st and March 8th, and my understanding is that there is an amendment that Representative Barreto, Parks, and ODOT have been working on, and if I don't have it at the moment, I will have it shortly, and I believe if it's the chair's wish, we will carry this over and work it on the 15th.
So it's my understanding there is an amendment that should be to this committee any moment, but as of right now, we don't have it yet. So Representative Barreto, I think if you don't mind, rather than have you speak to the amendment today when we actually don't have it in front of us, we'll roll this to next Wednesday if that's all right with you.
That would be fine, Madam Chair. I did. I didn't get it until late yesterday. I had my staff at 8 o'clock this morning. I told them to go ahead and file it. So.
Okay. And we were thinking we might have it in time this morning, but I don't think we're going to. So if you don't mind, we'll move this on to Wednesday.
I'm good with that.
Okay, great. And I will close the hearing and possible work session on 2910. And Representative Bentz should be walking in the door any moment. But since he is not here, I'm going to go ahead and reopen our public hearing on House Bill 2464 and invite Mr. Campbell up to talk to us about Orgo and Rough Tough.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA. I've been a member of Rough Tough for a number of years. Unfortunately, I'm temporally challenged, so I can't tell you how many years, but I find myself on these wonderful groups where you talk about very technical things, and the years just seem to fly by. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2464. What I'm going to talk to you about today is the why as opposed to the what. I'll get into the what a bit as well. The first one is why a road user charge, specifically one that's based on per mile amount, that's been discussed generally, but AAA has long been a supporter of inducing fairness in the way we tax motorists and truckers as well. In Oregon, we have the only state in the union that has a true, robust weight mile tax for trucks. And essentially what the road user charge is, it's a weight mile tax for cars without the weight component. From an engineering standpoint, vehicles that are 10,000 pounds or less, their weight really doesn't have any impact on the damage and wear and tear they put on the road. There are other factors that cars contribute, but weight is not one of them. So the assignment of a per-mile tax is the fairest way to capture it, because essentially what we have right now is a fuel efficiency tax, so that if you have a Ford F-150, you're paying more than your fair share. Mm-hmm. If you're driving a Tesla or a Leaf, you're paying, well, essentially nothing, so you're not paying anything into the road system, even though you're imposing a cost on that system. So the road user charge is designed to capture that, to make sure that everyone is paying their fair share, and a per-mile tax is the fairest way to do that. Also, Oregon is in a unique position to be doing this first, mostly because of a presentation you're going to be getting next week on something that we're constitutionally required to do every year, and that's our cost responsibility study. And what that is, it's a very in-depth study. You're going to be hearing about it a great deal more, but it gives us a very clear idea of what each automobile is responsible for as far as what is the cost that they impose on the road. The fee that we have started with the road user charge and the pilot, is about a penny and a half a mile. That penny and a half a mile is based upon that study, because we know this is how much money comes in from cars, and this is what we expend on the road system because of cars' use of that system, and it comes out to 1.5. That also leads us to, why do we have a cutoff at 20 miles per gallon? I'm not in the current Orgo program, but I was on a previous one. My vehicle happens to get 20 miles per gallon. So the way that worked is I would go and I would fill up with my gas tank, and it would record the number of miles, and then I would get about a 15-cent reimbursement from the state, because I was right on that cusp. Anyone who's driving in a vehicle that gets worse than 20 miles per gallon is essentially, as I said, paying more than their fair share. So all you would be doing is creating an unnecessary administrative burden on the state for them paying the tax and getting this reimbursement. Unless, of course, you chose to give them the reimbursement back based upon their fuel efficiency of their vehicle. So my advice is, while we have the program in place, if you have a really bad fuel efficiency vehicle, sign up for Orgo, because you're going to be getting some of your money back because you're overpaying your tax obligation. Why 2026? We have a specific provision in there that says that this program doesn't become required until the automobile fleet of 2026. You don't start paying into this tax unless you buy a vehicle from that time later. There are two reasons for this. Well, there's three. The first is that automobile manufacturers have to meet CAFE standards. And there's a concern that if you impose a per-mile tax only on high fuel efficiency vehicles, it will dull the desire of the buying public to buy those higher fuel efficiency vehicles. And as a result, they won't be able to meet their CAFE standards. The second reason, and it's very similar, it's that it also puts a dampening effect on those who would like to buy electric vehicles. And from an environmental standpoint, we want to encourage people to buy electric vehicles. But if you have this strange new tax system that you have to adopt at the same time you're moving to an electric vehicle, it stops that from happening as robustly. By waiting until 2026, the CAFE standard should be at their end, and it gives enough time between now and then for the electric vehicle kind of fleet to build up and for people to become more comfortable with them, for the technology around electric vehicles to lower the price that are currently disadvantages. The third thing, and I think quite frankly the most important thing, is if Oregon is going to move to a road user fee system, we've got to do it right the first time. We can't afford to fail, because it has some challenges with public perception. So if you have a problem at the get-go, you're going to be waiting another 10 or 15 years before you can try to re-implement And because our goal is to prevent the kind of the bleeding effect that fuel efficiency and gas prices are currently having as a mechanism for raising funds, we need to make sure that we get it done as soon as we can, but doing it right. By waiting until 2026, it gives ODOT the ability to continue to work through all of the problems with the program to get it right, and it gives you as the legislature 9 years to watch that program and make sure when it's on the cusp of being implemented, you can say, we're good to go, or wait a minute, we need to come back, revisit this, and give a little bit more time. So that's the primary reason for the date of 2026. Now, we do have some challenges associated with this program. Administratively, it costs more. One of the most administratively efficient tax systems that we have is the gas tax. It almost costs nothing administratively to administer. But if we're going to move to this system, this does have some administrative requirements, especially if you're going to allow things like options for hand reporting of odometer readings when you're reporting. So that's going to be a challenge, and there's a cost. That cost will come down as technology improves and as the public is more accepting of those technological solutions. Also enforcement, because we don't really have points to check up on the odometer readings except when you buy or sell a car. And so the ability for us to say, okay, you didn't pay your road user fee the way you should have, what's the fallback position? ODOT has developed something that actually kills two birds with one stone. One is it creates an alternative approach where you essentially pay a flat fee for the number of miles you travel. You estimate I'll travel about 15,000 miles this year, so you just pay that either in a monthly or an annual flat fee that assumes you're running 1,500 miles at the rate under the tax. They can also impose that. If you don't pay that tax on your per mile or you disable your device or whatever else, they can just move you to that as a way to make sure that you're paying your obligation under the tax. We also will have a problem with non-Oregon drivers. There's two ways to deal with that. The one is the way Origo currently works, and that is we'll continue to have a gas tax underlying the road user fee. So if you come in from out of state, you don't have a dongle that tells us how many miles you're traveling in the state, you're not signed up with a program, at least we'll be capturing a portion of what you should be paying when you go and fill up your tank when you're in the state of Oregon. The other approach, and this is just a longevity issue, is eventually other states will also adopt this approach, and as you get a regional approach, you're going to have less and less folks who are operating outside of a road user fee system, so you're not going to have as many outliers. And then the last issue that we'll eventually have to deal with, and we haven't grappled with this in the rough, tough meetings, and that is what do you do with medium-duty fleet vehicles, those between 10,000 pounds and 26,000 pounds, your UPS delivery trucks, things like that. Right now, of course, as I mentioned, we've got trucks that are paying the weight mile tax. If we move to a road user fee for 10,000-pound trucks or less, we capture them, and then we have this strange anomaly of those 10 to 26,000-pound trucks. We still have to deal with that. It's not a huge portion of the fleet. It's not a huge portion of the contribution to the transportation system from a tax perspective, but it is something that creates an odd anomaly that we will eventually have to address. With that in mind, because of AAA's dedication to making sure that motorists and trucks all pay their fair share, not only as groups but as individuals, we support House Bill 2464 and hope you will support it as well. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Campbell, thank you, sir. A couple questions if this has already been considered. So the current rate mile tax or the tax is 1.5 cents a mile. If we increase our, if we pass a transportation package this year, will that change that amount? Or in the future, in 2026, who is the authority and what kind of event would precipitate a change in that tax, and what's the process of that changing or increasing?
Madam Chair, Representative Meek, that's actually a very good question. You would start to treat that per mile cost exactly the same way you do the gas tax. So if you increase the gas tax, then that 1.5 cents would increase in a proportionate amount. The other way that it would likely change is, and again, you're going to learn about this fund-loving study next Wednesday, the cost allocation study. What it does is it says, are cars paying their fair share, are trucks paying their fair share in comparison to each other? If you had a study that says, you know what, trucks are paying more than their fair share and cars aren't paying enough, then there would be a recommendation to come back to the legislature and say, well, really cars should be paying 1.6 cents per mile or 1.7 cents per mile, and then it would be up to you as the legislature to rectify that through adjusting those fees. But I can't imagine it not being anything other than a legislative responsibility to adjust the per mile fee, just like you do the gas tax.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your time. And on that note, I am going to close our public hearing on 2464. And I believe that Representative Bentz will be walking in the door momentarily.
You said that 20 minutes ago.
Right. How close is he, Mr. Walker? I have a note.
I just received an email that he's on his way.
All right. Sure. Let's go ahead. We have one bill that we want to do a work session on. So let's go ahead and open our work session on House Bill 2291. Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2291 clarifies there is no exemption from heavy truck regulations for farm vehicles that carry hazardous material loads in interstate commerce. Allows the Department of Transportation enforcement officers to issue citations for violation of obscuring truck license plates on out-of-state vehicles, and changes weight calculation methodology for commercial buses with respect to the weight mile tax. We have a dash one amendment, and the dash one amendment deletes the provisions related to hazardous materials, and it identifies that the measure applies to conduct occurring on or after the effective date. We have a minimal fiscal impact, and there's a modest revenue impact due to the change in the calculation of how buses are charged under the weight mile tax, but it's not enough to warrant a subsequent referral to the House Revenue Committee.
So just to be clear on the dash one amendment, and I don't know if anyone from ODOT wants to comment, one of the concerns that we had about this bill had to do with the issue around particularly agricultural, our farmers and ranchers on the hazmat issue, and the dash one amendment actually removes that from the bill. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So just the original two tenets of the bill remain?
Correct.
Okay. Vice Chair Lyle.
Chair McEwen, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 2-17-17.
Vice Chair Lyle moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 2-17-17. Is there any discussion?
Can you explain again what the Dash 1 does to the hazardous waste
I'm going to invite Ms. Joyce up to explain. It's my understanding that that is pulled out of the bill now.
Okay.
It is no longer in the bill.
Okay.
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, that's correct. The Dash 1 amendment strips out that the portion of the bill that dealt with farm-plated vehicles carrying hazardous materials. There were concerns raised in the earlier committee, particularly around the relating clause and some other issues. So working with the agricultural community and staff, the Dash 1 strips out that portion, leaving the other two provisions that have nothing to do with that topic.
Okay.
Vice Chair Lyle, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, so just to confirm, this was worked out with the Farm Bureau and the farming community to pull those out, correct?
Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Lyle, that's correct.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Lyle.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2291 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Vile moves House Bill 2291 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative
Hoyt. Aye.
Vice Chair Meek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Vile.
Aye.
Chair McEwen.
Aye. The motion passes. Do I have a volunteer to carry this bill? Vice Chair Meek will carry. Thank you very much. And we have Representative Bentz. Thank you for joining us, sir. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2491. Welcome to our committee, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cliff Bentz, State Representative District 60. Happy to appear before you today to talk about House Bill 2491. This bill creates the offense of using a disabled parking permit from another jurisdiction after being in Oregon for 90 days or more. This bill was requested by a gentleman from Bend who, under our Oregon statutes, is a volunteer who is allowed to issue citations for parking. What he noticed is that he would be handing out citations, wandering around the streets of Bend, and noticed that people with Oregon plates would still be using disabled signs from other states, and he thought that was wrong. We don't have a permanent disabled placard that we hand out. We have an 8-year rotation, and the idea there was to pick up people who were fraudulently using these things. He believes and says in his letter to me that he sees this happen over and over, and he has no ability to issue a citation. So the concept here is that citations could be issued if you were in Oregon for 90 days or more and failed to go obtain your Oregon placard that says you're disabled. It's a very simple bill. I have to say, I gave a lot of thought to whether or not to bring the bill, but this gentleman is very, very serious about it, and the problem that he's trying to address is a serious one. So that's why I'm here. There are other technicalities, so we've been handling those through Amy, so I'm hoping she'll be able to answer any of the technical issues having to do with the statutes. And there you have it. Happy to answer any question that I can.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Vile.
Chair McKeon, Representative Bentz, tell me what the deal is with these vigilante enforcement folks. Are they qualified somehow? Are they given credentials? How does this work?
Right, so there's a statute that allows this, and I did have it, but I don't see it here in front of me. I think I'm going to take a couple of assumptions here for you. One would be that probably there's been a thought that rather than hire more people in government jobs, we could have this kind of thing done by people if they volunteer. Now, whether they're and that's probably being done in lieu of having more folks as police officers, and all the issues that go with adding to the purge problem and that difficulty. So I think these volunteers are probably welcome by overworked and overburdened city police forces. That'd be my guess, but we'd have to ask somebody that actually knows, because I don't. I don't know if there's, I'm going to take another guess and say that under the statute, there's processes that people have to use to make sure that citations aren't being handed out willy-nilly to suspecting folk. But that's all I know about it, which isn't much.
Ms. Joyce, do you have anything to add here? Would you like to join us for a moment? Any other questions for Representative Bentz? I'm sure he has other things that are demanding his attention. If there are no other questions, Representative Bentz, thank you for bringing this before us.
Thank you.
All right.
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I don't have much to add. I think just in further response to Vice Chair Vile's question, there's a specific provision in statute that indicates people may volunteer to do this work, and they have to be. That has to be an initiative of the local law enforcement, the local police.
Okay.
And so there's a program that an individual community would have to do this, and then that is up to that jurisdiction to figure out what the credentials are, what the training is, whatever that is. There's no oversight by ODOT or anyone, but it is specified in statute that this is permissible.
Ms. Joyce, I think from that it would be, and I don't know if you can provide any data, but it would be interesting to know if in this particular jurisdiction that Representative Bentz is alluding to, there's a significant problem with out-of-state people who have moved in and are taking advantage, or is this a more statewide application? Is this a problem just in Bend, or we see? Do you have any sense as to whether we're seeing this problem on a more statewide?
Chair McEwen, parking violations are one of the things that DMV does not record. So we, I don't believe, would have data on how many tickets are issued or convictions for that particular offense, for a parking offense. I will tell you that the program person who deals with the disabled person parking placard program, say that five times fast, has indicated to me that anecdotally she does receive complaints from folks who will call in and say that, you know, they believe that this is happening, but I don't have any data or numbers on that.
And so if we create an offense of failure to obtain an Oregon disabled parking permit, is this basically a parking ticket? I'm curious as to, could you detail a little bit what the offense would actually be?
Chair McEwen, I apologize. I don't have the bill in front of me and was not prepared to testify today. I'd be happy to follow up with whether this is becomes somehow a moving violation, although I don't think it would. I apologize. I was not prepared today, and I could come back and provide information to the committee.
Chair McEwen, right here. It says it's a Class D traffic violation.
So what does a Class D traffic violation mean?
Chair McEwen,
I'm trying to get a sense of what we're going to tag them with.
Right. Chair McEwen, I apologize.
No problem. I think what I would like is just a little more detail about what this offense actually is. I think we have some more information to gather on this. So what I would like to do is go ahead and close this hearing, and
Madam Chair,
we can revisit it. Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Representative Noble.
Thank you, Chair. Some comments maybe I could clarify since
that would
I have
be
some
helpful.
Experience. The volunteer parking, disabled parking program is something that was authorized by the legislature years ago, and several cities use it. It is born out of the police department, usually with other volunteers or non-sworn people who go through code enforcement officers who have an opportunity to observe these violations. All go through training, all go through the same scrutiny, a lot of times, several times a photograph identifying the violation goes with the citation and then goes through the court process. Anecdotally, the issue here I've seen in Corvallis and McMinnville and on the Linfield campus where we have several disabled parking. So I don't know if it's a huge volume, but it is an issue.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Yes. Question. Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the process for somebody coming in out of state to receive or apply for one of these placards? And what's the time frame for approval?
Chair McEwen and Vice Chair Meek, the process would be to either come into the DMV or mail in the information. There's an application form in which a physician or medical professional signs off that the person qualifies for the type of mobility or vision or other types of conditions that qualify you for the placard. It is free. There is no fee for the placard. And the issuance, if you come into the DMV, the issuance is right there at the counter. If you mail it in, obviously it's sent out. And then if you have a permanent placard, it's synced up with your driver's license, which is synced up to your birthday. So you come in, you renew your driver license on your on or around your birthday, and you would renew that placard at the same time.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Mayo.
Chair McEwen, I'm in the summary. It says it's a maximum fine of $250. Is that what a Class D traffic violation just typically is? Is that how those sync up? Okay.
I'm asking too because these are areas I am not familiar with. Ms. Joyce, would you like to comment, and then
Chair McEwen, may I defer?
Yes,
to
you
Representative
may.
Noble,
Representative Noble, thank you for your expertise in this area.
Indeed,
thank you. Without that directly in front of me, that sounds consistent with Class D traffic infractions. It's a maximum fine. I just note that the underlying violation of misuse or parking in a disabled spot without a placard is actually a Class C traffic infraction. So this is below that, which I think is appropriate.
All right. Thank you. I think we will bring this back. And Ms. Joyce, if you could just bring us a little bit more detail next time, that would be helpful. I think
thank
there's
you,
some
Chair.
Interest in this. And we will close our hearing on House Bill 2491. And I would like to reopen, once again, our public hearing on House Bill 2464 and invite Mr. Dirksen up to testify. Thank you for joining us this morning, sir.
Thank you for having me, Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify, and I want to testify in favor of House Bill 2464, which removes the cap and changes the process for applying a per mile charge to automobiles in lieu of or in addition to.
I'll need your name for the record, sir.
Thank you. My name is Craig Dirksen, and I am a member of the Metro Council and a former mayor of Tigard, and in both of those capacities served on the Road User Fee Task Force, the state task force that brought forward this bill and also the previous bill, Senate Bill 810, which created the voluntary program for a per mile charge as well. So this is the next step in the process in creating what would be a sustainable and secure source of funding for road improvements and also road maintenance in the state of Oregon, with declining gas tax dollars that don't reach as far as they need to. Also vehicles, as they become more fuel efficient, using less gasoline, and also vehicles that are coming online now that use other forms of energy. I am actually a poster child for this. I drive a Chevy Volt, and have so for the last 4 years plus, and because it's a plug-in hybrid that uses gasoline only when the battery has become discharged. In the last 4 years, I've calculated that I've only paid about $40 in gas tax fees to drive my car on Oregon roads. And there's a greater number of these every day. It's going to become a bigger problem as time goes by. This bill will allow the existing program to expand and eventually apply to all vehicles over a period of time. I don't know how familiar you are with the bill, but it would eventually it would switch over in the model year of 2026, where all new vehicles would be required to pay a per mile fee instead of paying gas taxes. And so this would pick up all the different new kinds of vehicles that don't use gasoline, as well as those who are much more fuel efficient and as such don't pay enough into gas tax program in order to provide a secure funding source that the state of Oregon needs for improvements to and maintenance of its highway system. So I'd be very supportive of the language in the bill and would recommend to the committee that they move it forward.
Yes, Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, Mr. Dirksen, I too drive a Volt, and I have been thinking about this issue a lot. I'm really glad that we had this come up today. I'm wondering, though, in your position, you've got a lot of time to work on and think about how we're paying for our roads.
I do.
And I'm wondering if you think this really isn't the long-term solution to getting to a revenue point that we can really maintain and improve our road system. Is there something else besides this, or does this need to be beefed up? Do we need to be more? Do we need to impose greater charges than what this would do? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think this is a step in a process, and like everything else, you move forward in small steps and you look and see what the impacts and effects are of what you've done and see whether that's adequate, and then you make further adjustments in the future if that's necessary. I think there's other things that could be done to help alleviate challenges around funding that might also be able to favorably impact areas that are fully congested, but this is one step. This, like many things that we do, we create a tool It is not the only tool we need, but it is a tool that we need.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're very welcome. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill here seems like it would average everything out at 20 miles a gallon. And so if your vehicle gets a better mileage than that, it would bring you back to paying this 20 mile a gallon fee. But you just mentioned that in 2026, I think, that all vehicles would follow under this. And yet those that are getting less than 20 miles a gallon would be paying more with the current gas tax. So would then they be discounted?
Well, this would only, I think it only applies to vehicles that get 20 miles per gallon or greater.
Okay, and that's
so
not changing.
Even in 2026, vehicles that get lower than that would still continue to just pay gas tax.
Okay,
gas tax will still be with us for a long, long time, even if we embrace this new funding model. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it, Vice Chair Vile, that you mentioned that I didn't say, but in addition to my other duties, I also chair JPACT, which is the Transportation Committee for the Portland metro area.
Mm-hmm. Sir, I think it's interesting to note that we started this process, I believe, in 2006.
Well, actually, the Road User Fee Task Force was actually formed in 2001.
2001.
And we've been through, this is like the third step in the process as we've gone forward.
Well, I think the interesting thing about that is this is not happening quickly. This is being done very deliberatively and thoughtfully over a very long horizon because we've been at this a long time in mm-hmm. Oregon. And I think that's part of the reason that other states are looking to us as a model is we're doing this very carefully and thoughtfully. And we want to get it right, as Mr. Campbell said. We want to make sure that we're doing this properly as we ramp up to a different horizon. So thank you.
I appreciate that comment. Yes, it's very important when you're doing something for the first time that you do so in a very slow and deliberative way. Mm-hmm. You only have one chance to make a first impression.
That's right. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
Representative McLean.
I just want to wish you well tomorrow at JPAC. And we are hoping for a very positive phone call. And we're looking forward to working with you on transportation here shortly.
Thank you very much. I feel confident that we will have a positive result tomorrow, and I appreciate your comment.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Let's see, closing the public hearing once again on House Bill 2464 and opening, where are we? We are at opening a public hearing on House Bill 2290. And do I have a list here? Mr. Walker, update us a little bit here.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2290 adjusts certain fees imposed by the Department of Transportation, Division of Motor Vehicles. This is a periodic study that they undertake to find out what fees are paying for themselves and which are not, and any adjustments they need to make.
And I'd like to call up Mr. McClellan, Mr. Fuller, and Catherine. I can't read it. I'm sorry.
Weber.
Weber, thank you.
Just a right click on advance.
And Tom, if you wouldn't mind starting us off here.
Okay, great.
Welcome to the committee today.
Thank you very much. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV administrator with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here to testify on House Bill 2290. DMV's mission includes collecting revenue for Oregon's transportation system. The division generates revenue through fees, and nearly all of those fees are set in statute. So you decide what those fees should be, and a few exceptions to that, but almost entirely through statute. So what we found through cost studies over the last few years is that several of our products and services yield less in fee revenue than they cost to produce. House Bill 2290 proposes to raise fees to recover those costs, but it also seeks to reduce the complexity of the fees charged. I think an equally important purpose of this bill. Fees collected by DMV support three core purposes. They cover the direct and indirect costs of running our division. They provide funding for the transportation infrastructure debt service on construction bonds and collect revenue for the state's highway fund, including for city and county transportation purposes. Here we go. Most DMV fees were originally set to cover to recover the cost of their service, with vehicle registration fees set to also produce state highway fund revenue, so a profit basically built into the registration fee. Over the past 15 years, transportation funding packages for the Oregon Transportation Investment Acts, OTIA, and the Jobs and Transportation Act included DMV fee increases. These legislatively approved fee increases were earmarked to pay principal and interest on construction bonds issued for highway projects completed that were under those acts. So essentially what it did was it masked the underlying kind of core base fees of DMV have not really changed. Even though we're collecting more revenue, it's being used for, you know, transportation, bond repayment type purposes. But the core fee itself, in many cases, has not been changed since the 80s or 90s. And that's part of what we're looking at here today. Today, the cost to produce many DMV products and services exceed the fees collected. There we go. Even though we've had really static staffing at DMV, the FTE that we've had over the past several years has not changed all that much. The transaction volumes for us has changed quite a bit. It's actually grown. When you take a kind of a market basket of transactions, it's grown by a little over 12% during this period of 2010 through 2016. Essentially, we're doing more with less with our organization. In 2013, we conducted an extensive study of our costs and our fees. It was guided by an advisory group that included the Legislative Fiscal Office and other experts from outside of ODOT. The study examined 72 different fees and fee categories, and we identified those that need to be raised, some significantly, to cover their full cost. The study also identified some services provided without charge due to lacking statutory authority to charge a fee, such as a motorcycle knowledge test or a commercial driver license combination knowledge test. Those were provided without charge. The majority of insufficient fees are related to driving privileges. Those are really driver control type activities and driver licensing, instruction permits, skills testing, those types of things. Fees for vehicle titling and registration are intended to not only cover their cost, but also raise money for the state highway fund. However, the result of some fees not keeping up with costs is that funds intended for building and maintaining highways are now subsidizing other parts of our operation. Some of the current fee amounts create what I consider unintended consequences. So when your fees are low, sometimes it causes other things to happen. For example, someone can avoid buying registration tags, which are $86 for a two-year registration, and complying with vehicle emissions testing, which is tied to registration expiration at the Department of Environmental Quality. They can do that by transferring plates onto their vehicle. The current fee to transfer a plate transfer, to transfer plates from one vehicle to another, is $6. It doesn't recover our costs, which is about $30, and tends to create an incentive for people to transfer plates from one vehicle to another, and like I said, avoiding paying a higher registration fee. In some cases, it's being reported primarily in the Portland area where people are stealing plates off of vehicles, taking them into our offices and just registering them for their vehicle. Again, to avoid paying a registration fee. Two-year registration is $86. A four-year registration for a brand-new vehicle is $172, plus a $24 plate fee for the new plates. So it's a disincentive, or a reverse incentive, basically, that we think should be addressed. Especially as registration fees are being considered for increases, this plate transfer fee really ought to be looked at. And that is one that is in the bill. Another example of an unintended consequence is that we are essentially undercutting the private sector on our third-party testing program. So the private businesses that are doing Class C regular drive tests and CDL testing are charging a much higher rate than we are charging currently at a DMV office. An example of that is a regular drive test at DMV is $9. Most of the third-party testers are charging $45 to $50 to recover their costs and probably a little profit margin as well. A CDL test at $70 is far less than what the third-party CDL testers are doing across the state. So unintended, but that is something that's happening as a result of these fees being as low as they are. The bill also streamlines several fees, really to reduce complexity, make the fees similar for similar transactions, so we have more consistency, which is better for the public, better for our employees. It's more efficient in that way. Examples include making all CDL endorsement tests the same fee. The work essentially is the same for us, and the bill proposes that be a $200 fee for a change or an addition of an endorsement to a CDL license, and charging a $78 title fee for both heavy and light vehicles. Today, a heavy vehicle, you pay $90 for the title, light vehicle at $77. The work for us is essentially the same. We're proposing $78 to make it basically, you know, cost neutral, revenue neutral, based on our cost revenue neutral at $78. So one would go down, one would go up slightly. Another part of this bill is we're trying to streamline the legislation itself. In many cases, you'll see it's a complex bill of like 31 pages, but in many cases, its length is because we're combining sections where the fee is the same for different types of services, like an original and a renewal or a replacement of a driver license. We're just combining that in the legislation. Makes the bill look much bigger than it really is as far as the changes we're making. As well as half the bill is conforming language. As you make changes like that, you have to true up your statutory references. So it looks like a big bill when you take a look at it, but it's really not when you start to break it apart like that. House Bill 2290 was drafted prior to publishing the most recent DMV cost of services study. That was in December of last year. Fees proposed in the bill are based upon that previous cost study in June of 2015. In attachment one, I hope you have my testimony, but the attachment has a summary of the fees that are proposed compared to the current fees, and then the two studies in 2015 and then in 2016. You can see where the cost came out compared to current fees and what's proposed in the bill itself. In addition to not including the most recent cost study, House Bill 2290 doesn't address another issue that's come to light fairly recently, is the price we charge for identification, for ID cards, both the original, the renewal, and the replacement of those cards. A recent study shows that what we should be retaining for our costs is closer to $25 per card issued. We currently retain about $18.25, I think it is, on each card issued for cost recovery. The net effect of that without changing the ID card fee is that the net revenue that goes to public transit, specifically senior and disabled transit in Oregon, the funding would be reduced as a result of that. So as we change our cost recovery for those cards, if the fee is not increased by approximately $7, there would be an unintended consequence of less funding for public transit in Oregon. So I bring that to your attention as a potential amendment to the bill if you're interested in pursuing the bill further. We also learned recently that we lack statutory authority to charge a fee for the training and the regulation of those third-party businesses that do today, you know, Class C and CDL testing. We select businesses to do that testing, and we provide oversight of their operations, so regulatory responsibilities, inspections periodically, those types of things. We don't charge them to participate in the program. There's no fee like a dealer might pay a certificate or a licensing fee. There's no fee charged to those businesses. That might be a consideration for this bill if you think we should be collecting some money for our costs for overseeing that program to run it as effectively as we could. A more robust program would be possible with better funding for that. Finally, fees for DMV records are not included in the bill. That is the exception to the fees set in statute. These are set in administrative rule. And while the cost study revealed that some of those fees also are not recovering their costs, the agency is deferring changes at this time, pending legislative decisions on the concept of cost recovery and concerns about raising too many fees at one time. So I didn't want to be coming here and talking to you about certain set of fees and then behind the scenes doing some administrative review changes that affected those fees. So we've put that on hold to see if cost recovery is as a principle or a policy that you want us to pursue in the future. In my time with DMV, we really haven't had an opportunity to bring this concept to you. And as I've said, many of these fees have not been changed in many, many years, except for those fee increases that were for the OTIA and JTA purposes. So I guess really a fundamental question for, I know you're not a budget committee, but you are a policy committee. This has got a lot of numbers associated with it. But I think the policy question really is, should DMV fees be recovering their costs? So I would pose that to you as a committee, but that's my testimony.
I think what I'd like to do, since Tom's here actually reporting on the exactual tenets of the bill, normally I would ask questions after the entire panel has spoken, but I think right now it's appropriate to make sure that we're getting questions to Tom. So Vice Chair Vial and then Mayor McLean.
Madam Chair, Tom, I'm hearing you talk about the concept of cost recovery, but I know that we're also having discussions about using these vehicle registration fees and other fees at DMV to raise money for purposes of maintenance and new roads, et cetera, new multimodal transportation as well. What I'm a little confused at this point. Currently, are we not doing any of the over and above our cost contribution back to the system?
Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Lyle, what has happened over time is the net revenue, profit, if you will, on that registration fee has gotten smaller and smaller. As our costs have grown over time, and as the principal and interest is due on the bonds that a lot of our fees are being used for, that net that's available for distribution, which is essentially 50% to the highway fund and 30 and 20% to the cities and counties, is becoming a smaller and smaller piece. And it's like the frog in the water. As you turn the water up, and it boils, it's the same type of thing. All this time of kind of not really looking at this, until we actually did the cost study, we didn't realize that it was having this kind of an effect. Because as I think the second or third slide I had up there shows, our revenues actually are higher. We're bringing in more money because of those increases, but it's dedicated. It should be reserved for those purposes, not for the purposes of our cost recovery.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
And do you have a sense of where we are relative to our neighbors or a national average on how our fee structure generally looks?
Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Vial, we have done some analysis of surrounding states. Our fees are typical to other states. Services are not consistent. Some, they do different things and provide it in different ways, so it's sometimes hard to make those kind of comparisons. Some, like a driver's license, might be for 4 years or 5 years, and ours is for eight. So we have to try to do some standardization, basically, as we look at other states. We're kind of in the ballpark. I do know that many of my peers in other states don't do cost studies. They really leave it up to more of a political decision of what the fee should be and ability to pay than really what the cost is. So to know that some states are charging less doesn't necessarily mean that they're recovering their costs either, just because it is set there.
Madam Chair, I just want to make a statement for the record that of all the agencies that I deal with in state government, DMV is my favorite, and I tell my family often that whoever's in charge of DMV must be doing a good job, because people are happy and they seem to be doing a very good job.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative McLean.
Well, I think that Representative Vial got started on some of the line of questioning that I had. It's just that, we've been working on the package and on the transportation thoughts on funding. And to me, this is something real important for Matt to bring to the subcommittee.
Okay.
Because we're talking about those very things. And timing is really an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's also, it's a communication of, should we recover costs? I think that's a good message. And I think people understand recovering of cost for a service provided that they want.
Right.
But there also is the timing in the package on as you're indicating, projects and concepts and systems that are coming out of the, out of the highway fund and other funding mechanisms.
Right.
So it just, this timing, and I understand it, you had your report in 2015, your report in 2016, and so this is a natural to come to this session.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there's some other projects going on that we've got to integrate.
Yes.
And we've got to talk about both messaging and actual saturation of cost for folks, and maybe how we can kind of adapt that. Maybe it's not all recover all costs this year.
Right.
Maybe it's recover costs over a two-year biennium or something else. But we've got lots of issues here. We've got a new program that supposedly is going to change from gas tax to, you know, a user fee in 2026 in a big way. And so all of these changes of both fees and systems will impact the overall ability of our 10 to 20-year program.
Right.
Thank you.
Representative Meek?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to your work on the raising of the identification card fee. I'm on the bill here, I don't see increasing the actual identification card fees, but what is the difference between an identification card and a limited-term identification card?
Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Meek, a limited-term card is one that's tied to a person's immigration status, and when if they're in the country for 2 years or 3 years as a student or as a worker, we issue a card that expires when that immigration document expires. So it's not a full eight-year card. When that passed in 2009, the legislature set a much lower fee for the limited term cards with the thought that, well, they're not getting 8 years worth of driving privileges or, in this case, an ID card privilege. But the cost to us is the same. The process is very similar for us to issue an ID card as it is for a driver's license and for a regular ID card versus a limited term card. So we're actually bringing that forward as a policy decision, basically, is should that fee be the same because of the cost, really, for us to provide that. So that's the difference. A standard ID card, which those provisions are not in the bill right now. I want to just emphasize that. The concern I had about our costs going up and less for public transit is something that could happen administratively with, again, an unintended consequence that a budget might be approved with certain spending for public transit, but the funds just won't be there.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Noble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, just one thing to add. I appreciated Representative McLean's comments, just of all the different things and the moving parts. Other committees I sit on, we're talking about housing issues and poverty levels and people being able to get to work both through transit and then driving. And I'm a little bit disappointed that your contemporaries in other states haven't taken on any leadership as well in studies and cost impacts. So I'm going to make an assumption that there are no studies that talk about any adverse impacts to those of lower economic means and their ability to comply with laws regarding driver's licenses and permits and those trying to actually do the right thing.
Right. Chair McEwen, Representative Noble, I'm not aware of any studies there. It was a consideration as you look through our table there, things like a reinstatement fee. There should be an incentive for someone to reinstate their driving privileges once they've taken care of or time has passed on suspensions that they have on their license. We want them to have a clean driving record, and next time they get pulled over, they don't get cited for driving while suspended. So you don't want that fee to be too high. But you'll see that our costs are actually higher than what we're proposing as the fee.
It's double, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, we didn't bring it in as purely, well, the cost is this, so the fee should be that. We actually did apply some judgment, I guess, to that, recognizing that many of the people that have suspended licenses that need to reinstate their fees are not high-income people. And we also have a program with the Department of Corrections that assists offenders with obtaining ID cards. If we raise the price of an ID card, we don't want to price them out. We want them to leave the institution with a valid ID credential issued by the state that they can use to obtain jobs and housing and bank accounts and all those things as well. So we have to factor those things in as well. But to your real question, I'm not aware of any study that's been done on the economic impact on different populations.
Representative Bretto.
Then we'll
move on. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understood the PowerPoint that you've gone from 300 employees, I think, in 2010 to 800 currently?
No. Look at the top number there. I don't think it's accurate, but, there you go. At the top is the total FTE. So 839, 839, 835. That's the total DMV budgeted positions that we have, FTE that we have. The shading shows you, just distinguishes between our field offices and our headquarters employees. I'm not sure the distinction really matters to you all that much, but we break it out kind of that way. As you can see, neither one has changed all that much over time. But at 827 FTE for 2016 is actually a little less than what we had in 2010. And that's when we went through, we had right-sizing within our agency, we had hiring freezes, you know, things like that, that definitely caused us to span of control as well. We ended up with fewer people.
No, thank you. I didn't get that.
Thank you.
Mr. Fuller, thank you for being here this morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller here on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association, Oregon Power Sports Association, Northwest Auto Trades Association. To begin with, I want to mention that I'm a member of the Vehicle Miles Traveled Club as well. I drive a Suburban, so thank you very much for about $200 a year. I wonder if maybe Representative Vial and I shouldn't just cut out the middleman. You can just write your checks to me since you're driving Colt. Might be able to save a little bit of money that way. I've been a lobbyist representing car dealers since 1996. It's my hope one day to graduate and become a lobbyist for DMV, because if you check, you'll find that if people have a choice between going to the DMV and going to a car dealer, they like DMV better than they like us. I think that probably says more about us than it does about them. Nevertheless, vehicle dealers in the state of Oregon are one of the largest third-party tax collectors for the state of Oregon. Right, you buy a car from a car dealer, we collect the licensing and registration fees on behalf of the state, and we give them to the state of Oregon. So that makes us a pretty good barometer in some cases on how people are feeling about the taxes and the fees that they pay for their motor vehicles. And alongside with the field agents they have that collect those fees at the window, there's always a little bit of sticker shock, I think, among the public. That being said, we support the idea of cost recovery for the fees. We think that's appropriate. We're supportive of the bill in general. We think it's a good idea. There is one fee listed in the bill that we do have a little bit of heartache with, and it's actually the one that Mr. McClellan highlighted in his testimony. So I want to provide a different perspective on just that one fee, just for your edification. That has to do with the plate transfer fee. Currently, if you own a vehicle and you buy another vehicle and you want to transfer the existing license plate you have to your new vehicle, it costs you $6. And they're increasing that to $30, which is a pretty substantial jump to move a license plate that you own from one vehicle to another. So I would, I guess I would comment from two perspectives. One is, what you're doing is changing the VIN number associated with a license plate. I guess, and I haven't done a deep dive into their cost recovery analysis, but I just have a hard time believing that it costs $30 in time and effort at DMV to change the VIN number associated with a license plate. Seems to me that that ought to be a pretty quick and easy thing to do. And there are lots of people out there that have specialty plates or vanity plates that like to keep that from vehicle to vehicle. For a long time in my family, we had a license plate. It was PET321. And my wife is a big animal lover, and she loved the idea that we inadvertently got a license plate that had the word pet on it. So it was important to her that we keep that pet license plate, and we did for a long time. So it was worth it for her to do that plate transfer fee. So again, I'm not sure that $30 is cost recovery. The other aspect of that is that my daughter, who came home from a year of doing missionary work, got in her Jeep Liberty and drove down to Klamath Falls, where her grandparents lived, to visit my parents. Shortly outside of Klamath Falls, her Jeep Liberty spun a bearing. Now, I have no idea what spun a bearing means, and I even represent the auto repair industry. What I do know is that it means that I have a very big piece of scrap metal. They said, not worth it to repair. I had just gotten new tags on that vehicle for my daughter's car, and I had paid the 80 or whatever it is for a two-year tag for that vehicle, and now I got to get a new one. I would like to save that $70 or $80 because I just paid for 2 years. And I should be able to transfer that license plate to her new vehicle instead of having to buy another two-year tag, because the license plate's not going to stay with the scrap metal. Right? The scrap metal is going to be scrapped. So in a 30-some-odd-page bill, 31-page bill, The good thing is I agree with Mr. McClellan on all of it but one line, and that's line 21 on page 1. We think that the jump from $6 to $30 is just a little too much. We certainly think a $10 or $12 increase or increase to $10 or $12 might make some sense. But we do think that $30 is a fairly substantial jump. And we do a lot of plate transfers on behalf of customers in our dealerships and just believe that when they look at that $30 transfer fee to move their license plate from one vehicle to another, some of them are going to comment on that. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Fuller, in a bill of this magnitude, if you have an issue with one line, I'm going to call it a win. Ms. Weber, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Chair McEwen, Co-Chair Meek, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Weber, and I'm with the Atkinson Graduate School Institute for Modern Government, which is across the street at Willamette. Our chair, John Radford, was for 13 years the comptroller for the state. He was unable to be here today, but he supports the portions of the bill that we are here to testify about, and that is around the fees. Our institute was contacted by Tom McClellan early in 2013 with an interest in having us help them evaluate the cost of service and products compared to current fees. The last comprehensive match between cost and fees had been done about 13 years earlier in the 1999 biennium. DMV has an advisory or formed an advisory committee to give us some input and for us all to do a professional review and feedback. We had former CFO, we had members from LFO and several internal managers from ODOT as part of the committee, and myself. And I am a former member of Senate Transportation Committee way back when, anyway. DMV wanted to obtain current information on the cost of providing products and services compared to fees charged. The administrator had put aside or had created an internal team to formulate a study methodology, perform the analysis, and draft recommendations. Our group looked at technical policy and political elements of the fee study and vetted them through our advisory committee and confirmed that the approach was sufficiently developed to determine if any adjustments were required. Our role specifically was to review the materials on cost analysis and methodology, draft recommendations, and assist with finalization of the recommendations, and also to provide input to the resulting proposals and recommendations. Basically, what we came up with was that what they were doing was the correct and adequate approach that they were taking. Our board members have continued to stay in touch with the progress DMV is making in transforming their program. We were pleased to see that the fee analysis was further refined in 2015 and in 2016. Overall, IMG supports DMV plans and DMV plans for their fee structure administration.
Thank you very much for your work.
You're welcome.
Questions for this panel?
Thank you very much.
I think it's clear. We will bring this bill back one more time. Of course, this is just a public hearing, so we appreciate your input. I think Representative McClain already drew attention to the fact that around transportation funding in this cycle, there are a lot of moving parts with the development of a transportation package. I think it's fair to assume that this bill will go down to Ways and Means to lie in repose for a period of time.
That's a good word, right?
Until a number of other things are worked out as we move towards bringing a transportation package to the floor of the House sometime the first part of June. So thank you so much for bringing it to us. Hopefully we can get this bill down to Ways and Means to sit there for a little bit, and as other things are determined, this bill will be considered. So unless anyone has anything else to add or questions for this panel, thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2290. Mr. Walker, could you just give us the highlights of what's going to happen next Wednesday?
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, we will bring House Bill 2910 back, and we have the amendment currently, so we should be able to work it. We'll have a work session on 2745, which is the Central Oregon Transportation Bill, and we'll have public hearings on House Bill 2749 and House Bill 2750, which have to do with the Hood River White Salmon Interstate Bridge. House Bill 2922, which will increase the surcharge collected for the Crater Lake National Park registration plates. House Bill 2596, which will decrease vehicle registration fee for truck tractor used exclusively to travel trailer for personal use. And the highlight will be the informational meeting on a highway cost allocation study from the Legislative Revenue Office.
Thank you. Without any further ado or comment, I believe we are adjourned. Thank you all.